Hey, everybody. So if you would like to support this show, we'd love it if you would by doing one of two things. First, let people know about us. Tweet us, Google Plus us, Facebook us, send links to your old grandma or something like that, whatever, right? Support the show, right? The other way you can support us is by going to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanny, sign up for a 1 month free trial membership, get a free audiobook of the deal, and if you really like the service, keep it and keep getting more audiobooks and enjoying, you know, the goodies. Okay, I'm gonna shut up now. Enjoy the episode, guys.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, is monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 122.
Otherwise known as the Mike Cole Hour.
That's it?
Yep, that's it.
Wow, real clever, Jen.
He's taken over every single topic that we have for the evening, so I figure I might as well give him the credit.
Well, Hold on a second. I did that because some rather desperate emails went flying in the beginning. We don't have a topic. Someone come up with something. And so I stepped into the breach, because stepping in the breach is what I do.
So I'm Sean.
I'm Jed.
I'm Paul.
And I guess obviously at this point, Mike Cole is our special super awesome guest.
I don't know if super awesome is the correct qualifier. How about your super talkative guest?
I'll go with super awesome because you're a military guy, which is hot, and then you're an attractive man, which is hot, and then you wrote a genre book, which is hot. I mean, the list keeps going on, man.
But it all seems to fall into the hot category.
Exactly.
You know what? I just wish once people would, when I walk into a room, they would look at my face and stop staring at the rest of me and just, you know, and listen to my words. You know, I'm more than just a pair of boobs. I'm a person and I have things to say.
Well, that's why I included
your mind is one of the things that he cited as hot. So
yeah, that's exactly what I want people to think about my mind. It's hot.
Hey, I mean, I'm sorry. Hey, I just had like a post about how one of the things that I like in science fiction and fantasy is a steamy romance because I'm a horny academic housewife. Really bad slip.
So horny that
it's not something I'm into.
Are you remembering, Jen, my horse related joke from last time?
Oh my god.
I missed this one. I missed this joke.
You'll have to listen to the episode of our review of
Breaking Dawn. And I really will. I really will. Well, you'll be pleased to know that I'm actually writing the first steamy romance of my career, which compromises currently the first third of Breach Zone, the third novel in the Shadow Ops series. A lot of romance going on there.
Sexy pants.
Yes, I'm very excited about it. Hopefully I didn't screw it up.
Okay, I appreciate that.
So our topics today fall into two different versions of categories. One is things Mike wants to know if we're going to be bothered by.
Right.
And then things that piss off Mike.
Right. And what I like about both of those topics is that they end with the word Mike. I think it's a very good indicator of a successful topic in a podcast.
Indeed. So what's the first part of the things that piss off Mike? Because we did discuss that The Hobbit would be the first thing that we talk about.
Right.
No, I think just
things that Mike wonders whether it'll tick us off.
Bother us.
I was about to say, because if you were going to say that The Hobbit was the first category, it really should be The Hobbit, Mike. And then
I'm sorry. My apologies.
But in any case, so The Hobbit comes out, I think, on the 17th?
14th.
Whatever. So the day I'm flying out. So maybe if I'm lucky, my airplane will be awesome and they'll put it on there, but they won't.
But in any case,
it comes out. We've talked about this before, but they are now making three movies. for The Hobbit, so it'll now be a proper trilogy instead of two films, supposedly because there's lots of, like, stuff that they didn't get to do in Lord of the Rings that they're now going to do for this. So I guess, Mike, you really wanted to see our reactions. Like, what do we think? Is this going to turn out good?
Yeah, I mean, that's my first question. The trailer, I mean, I see a couple of things here that make me optimistic. And the first, obviously, is it's Peter Jackson again. And I think that one of the big smart moves that Jackson made when he made the trilogy was that he used the watercolor painter Alan Lee's basic visual framework to conceptualize the universe. And I just think that of all the artists, you know, even the brothers Hildebrand, who have tried to paint and bring Tolkien's universe onto a page, Lee has just blown all the others away. And I really feel like those three movies are Alan Lee's watercolor paintings come to life. And I see a lot of that in the trailer for The Hobbit. The thing that makes me, I mean, those two things, both Peter Jackson directing and Alan Lee's concept, but the thing that makes me a little nervous is that if I remember The Hobbit correctly, the best part of it, I mean, the thing that really made it work, it is all at the end. It's the barrel, Mr. Underhill riding a barrel. It's the Battle of Five Armies. It's, you know, the arrow that he's always had. It's the baiting of Smaug and the verbal games they play. And it seems to me like that would all wind up in a single movie, and that a lot of the stuff that is less interesting about the book
would be confined to the first.
Right.
Yeah, you know, to an extent, except that I would argue that the fact that The Hobbit was initially a children's story. So the stuff that you know, didn't necessarily make it the most successful portion of the story to a kid was still really, really cool. The journey, you know, the travels, the fight with the trolls and going through Mirkwood. That's still all parts that as a child I loved. So I'm still excited about seeing, you know, how far he actually goes with the first film in terms of the storyline. It's a 3-hour movie.
Yeah. And here's my problem. Because
let's stop right there. Okay. I mean, which one did you want to cover, Sean? I mean, there's so many.
Related to specifically the vision, based on what I've seen in the trailer, obviously, because we haven't seen the damn movie. So obviously there's a certain bit of like cherry picking the bits and pieces they're going to show. My concern with this film is partly to do with what The Hobbit is it's essentially a book for kids, right? It was originally conceived of as a children's novel. So that to me tells me a lot about the kind of tone that it'll have. But we're also dealing with a 3-hour movie whose trailer does appear to contain a lot of the kind of childish glee, I guess you would kind of say. And yet this film series has a history that's associated with Lord of the Rings that I'm not sure that the general public is going to be able to disentangle it from. Mm-hmm. And I say that because people who've read Tolkien and are, you know, fans of Tolkien, et cetera, they know there's a difference, right? The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, they're drastically different kinds of novels. And so they'll go into The Hobbit going, I expect to see The Hobbit. But people who are not familiar with that maybe are thinking, oh, Peter Jackson's going back to Tolkien. We're going to get another epic series.
I would argue that nobody who was a fan enough of The Lord of the Rings and even knew that Peter Jackson was the guy who filmed them would go into The Hobbit not expecting The Hobbit.
Mm. I mean, I'm expecting The Hobbit, but I don't have this childlike recollection of it. And the thing, actually, one of the things that made me nervous is, you know, that song, whatever, da, 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 and crack the plates. That's what Bilbo Baggins hates. And then you see these. Paul, did you say something?
Yes, I did. I don't like to interrupt.
Ladies and gentlemen, Paul Weimer, welcome to the show.
See, Paul, I think really the problem is that you just need to learn how to interrupt because the rest of us do it all the time.
Yeah.
Well, go, Paul.
Okay. Well, I have some issues with the movie, and I'm less than 50% optimistic, and I will explain why. First of all, it is not only a trilogy, it's a 3-hour movie. And I'm just imagining, even if you threw in every bit from the appendices of the Lord of the Rings, which is what they're doing, into this movie, I just don't see where you're getting enough material to really really do it well. And then there's the technical issue I've heard about the movie. I don't know. I'm much more of a photography oriented than the three of you, but apparently the frame rate of this movie is being shot at 48 frames per second rather than a more normal 24, which I'm afraid that's going to make the movie look really, really weird, stilted, or artificial, especially compared to Lord of the Rings.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I just read an article from some critic who was reviewing it at the 48 frames per second. And apparently it takes a few minutes at that higher rate to even become accustomed to it, which was an interesting facet of it. But furthermore, some of the special effects, he said it, for the most part, it was really successful. It does look slightly false in entirety, but the parts that really fail are some of the special effects. Most of them are good. Apparently Gollum at the higher FPS is fantastic, but we have to keep in mind that the only theaters that are going to be showing the 48 frames per second are, there's, I think I heard there were only like 48 theaters or something. Not 48, obviously, because that would be
a much lower number.
It's only if you choose to see the 3D version. So if you're just going in to see a normal version, then it's 24. It's the normal rate. I'm not seeing it at 48 because I can't see 3D anyway. And so it was like, whatever.
So that's the question I have. Just a quick question. What exactly, I mean, other than the fact that there's more frames per second, but what does the 48 do visually, what is the difference that you would notice between a 24 and a 48?
There would be more frames per second.
Visually, like what would the...
How
would we see
this.
That?
So if they're normally shot with 20 frames per second, this is 48, so it's more than double the frames per second.
That's not what I'm asking.
No, seriously, check this out.
Actually, it's exactly equal.
Take the number of frames per second that you have in a normal film, double it, and add 8.
No. It's actually just double, period.
I understand that there are more frames per second. What I'm saying is, for if you go in and you sit in a theater and you try to, how would you describe the difference between visually the difference? Notice each individual frame, right?
Well, you would be like, wow, man, there's twice as much movie here.
No. I'll explain it for you and for the studio audience.
Thank you, Paul.
At 24 frames per second, which what standard movies look like, is actually slower than what you normally see with the human eye in real life. That's what gives movies their movie sort of feel. 48 is generally higher than what the human eye can capture, so things will look a little sped up. Animations and movements will look wrong, especially on a movie screen, because you're used to things and characters moving in a certain way and a certain speed in the movie, and here it's going to be twice as fast. You're going to have twice as many captures of images, and so it's going to look bad wrong, as Jen said with that reviewer.
Let me ask you this, Paul. I mean, if that's the case, obviously Peter Jackson wouldn't have made that choice. He doesn't deliberately want it to look wrong. What do you think Peter Jackson is hoping it will look like?
I think he's hoping to capture more detail, make it more true to life than 24, because 24, as I said, is movie time rather than real time. So he's trying to make it look more realistic, for lack of a better word.
Right. And the reason that it's at 48 frames, which, as Paul said, is higher than, you know, the human eye sees, is because every theater in the country is at 24 frames per second. So it's easy for them to transition to the 48 frames per second, as opposed to using a different, you know, whatever the math word is, to get to like a 40 frames per second or something like that, which, if I remember correctly, is what he would have preferred to have done. But due to the reality of the situation, he had to go with the 48. But it does create a sharper image, a much sharper image. And that's part of what people are like, I'm going to the movies to not see reality. So
essentially what we end up with visually is we had a much sharper image, and because all of us have watched movies at 24 or 20 for so long, we'll notice the movements may seem more dramatic because we're seeing more of the individual components of that movement.
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay.
I mean, I'm an American, and I've been raised to believe that more is better, and therefore I see this as a very good thing. However, I do want to raise one concern. Am I the only person who's not going to make it through a three-hour movie without having to pee?
Yes, you're the only one.
Oh, okay.
I've given birth, so theoretically I should have a problem.
Right.
So no whining.
I mean, I agree that that's, I mean, that was a problem with the original ones, right? With the Lord of the Rings series. They were three and a half hours long for the very last one. And, you know, nowadays, like, so this will go back to Jen, we'll get the reference again to the size of sodas. But, like, when Lord of the Rings came out, the medium soda was the size of a small now, right? And a medium soda now is like two of these bottles, right? But now a medium today is, I mean, it's like two and a half.
You know what?
Bottles
just go with
soda.
The joke.
Okay, look, the medium today is the size of a horse penis.
Wow. So that went from like really uninteresting to downright uncomfortable in just a couple of words.
Yes. So,
this is the Skippy and Vanti show in a nutshell. Yeah.
Well, you know, we got to earn our explicit tag. So,
yeah.
Right.
But I mean, that's the point. Like, you know, it's a 3-hour movie, and I think it goes back to Richard, your question you brought up earlier, Mike, was, or maybe it was Paul that brought it up. You know, what exactly are they taking to make this a 3-hour movie that is going to have a decent pace, et cetera, for this kind of film? I mean, maybe it's Peter Jackson. So, like, I'm hopeful that they're going to pull it off. But at the same time, you know, there's legitimate concerns about how they're going to pull something like that off for a 3-hour freaking movie. Not to mention, it's The Hobbit, so it's supposed to be kind of sort of for kids. I don't know many kids who are going to sit through a 3-hour movie.
Well, hold on a second. I never approached Tolkien's work as a kid's thing. And there was, and the kiddie part of it, if I remember correctly, or the part that I would say is best targeted for a younger audience is at the very beginning when the dwarves are crammed into Bilbo's house and all kinds of wackiness is ensuing. But once he walks out that door, man, it's pretty tough and pretty bleak.
Well,
and pretty clever.
No.
Go ahead, Paul.
Well, yes and no. There are some bleak moments, but you have goblins singing songs. You have the whole bit with the trolls, which is half comedy, half horror. You even have the bit with the spiders, which has weird elements of humor that you would never find in Lord of the Rings. I mean, people, when we finally get to the spiders in Mirkwood, people are going to wonder why it's not Shelob White instead of being so humorous.
Yeah. And
very
some of the
death.
Yeah, and some of the scenes like the troll scene and some of the other components are going to seem more like children's fairy tale kind of stories. You know, like Grimm's fairy tale kind of stuff, only maybe slightly sanitized. because I mean, with the particular troll scene, everyone knows the troll scene, right? Where they basically convince. I think if I recall correctly, he keeps them talking until dawn, right? But that's kind of a trope that's familiar for children's fairy tales. There is a certain darkness.
I particularly like the fact that he actually is, you know, performs something heroic and wins a victory just by talking a lot.
Yes.
That's very near and dear to my heart.
Clearly.
Obviously. But so, yeah, I mean, to me, this was a kid's story. My kids have read it. They've enjoyed it. Granted, you know, one of them has also read The Lord of the Rings, so who knows? But The Hobbit, my thing is, The Hobbit is like, even when I was a kid, I was maybe a 4-hour read. You know, it's not a long book, and it's fairly fast-paced. So how do you draw something that is that quick to read into essentially a 9-hour film?
Which is what maybe what will make me pleased is my concern earlier about, you know, people who saw Lord of the Rings are probably going to go see The Hobbit, not really necessarily being super big fans of Tolkien and expecting The Hobbit. So maybe what we're going to get is Lord of the Rings, but slightly withdrawn, so it's not quite the same epic format, but we're not so much going into the children's territory that, in fact, what we're ending up with is a kind of a children's epic. I don't know how you would describe it. Then maybe that's what those extra materials are doing, and he's finding a way to weave them together to create a much larger, bigger picture than just what we would have read in The Hobbit.
That maybe we'll get the Silmarillion tacked on. You know, he snuck it in there.
I don't know if he can, that's what
they've said is that he's not the entire Silmarillion, but he's put in extra material from the Silmarillion into the series.
Actually, it's more the appendices from the Lord of the Rings that he's putting in, not the Silmarillion itself, which he doesn't have the rights to.
Yeah,
but those appendices cover a lot of the stuff that happens around the Hobbit. The fight against the Necromancer, who turns out to be Sauron, and stuff with Radagast the Brown, and all that stuff is going to be churned in there. But how is that going to be a coherent narrative is a big question.
I don't know, guys. And maybe this is just because I want it to be good so badly. But even listening to you talk, Paul, about, you know, because I know any good nerd who had the original Del Rey version of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, where the Hobbit was gold colored and then I think the Fellowship was blue and the Two Towers was green. Do you guys remember? And
I have that one, yes.
Return of the King was red. Well, any good nerd who owned that box set went through, in the end of Return of the King, the appendices, and of course learned Quenya and learned how to write it and learned and read those appendices backwards and forwards. And so there's just such a huge nerd thrill in me at the thought of seeing even a little bit of that come to life on screen, especially if it's going to look like a moving Alan Lee watercolor.
Absolutely.
Our Fran Walsh and what's the other name? The other lady. I've forgotten. The people who worked with him on The Lord of the Rings for the writing, are they back?
I would imagine they are. I don't know, though.
That might be something to look at, because I think that might alleviate some of, like, because they did an amazing job with what shouldn't have even been freaking filmable, which is Lord of the Rings. So who knows? Maybe they managed to put it together, but I'm looking right now. But do we want to
switch? Yeah, they did.
Let's end on a positive note and move on to negativity.
Well, okay. I am positively, absolutely, I bought the midnight showing tickets the second that they came on sale, because that's how excited I am about this movie.
I'm going to see it, like, in theaters. It's one of the films I want to see. So.
I squee literally every time I hear the music or even see an image from The Hobbit. So I'm kind of a little bit too excited, probably.
Yeah, I'm not going to go.
Is the music by Howard Shore?
What?
Is the music by Howard Shore?
It's the same music as the last one, for the most part.
Hold on, I'm Googling this.
Yes, it is! It's Howard Shore.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. It's beautiful. I'm sorry. It's going to be amazing. I don't care what anybody says.
Well, it may be amazing. You may be right. This may be Peter Jackson's rejuvenation since...
crowning masterpiece. Yeah.
Since
The Lovely Bones, which was just a god-awful film.
Yeah, he's had and to be fair, like, he made something like freaking Lord of the Rings, and then I think nobody was gonna be satisfied with anything he made after that. But
yeah, that's probably true.
There's some but whatever. But anyways,
Sad Face, next.
So, all right, so are we moving on?
Yes.
Sure.
Okay, so things that will piss off Mike, which is he wanted us specifically to talk about why we need to stop venerating classic SF as the only SF of value, is essentially what I think you wanted to say.
I mean, not quite to that degree, but I really dislike the... I honestly believe that... art obviously can't be compared directly to technology, but I do think there's something to that, and that artists and writers create building on the platform of the people that came before them, and that there's been a tremendous amount of progress in the world socially and intellectually, and that is reflected in literature. And the fact is I've read Heinlein, and I've read Asimov, and I've read Jack Vance, and I've read Alfred Bester, and I don't like them. And I don't think that it's because, you know, if I don't like them, when I get into a conversation with people about it, I wish that could just be a conversation about opinions of writing and not this attitude that I just threw dog poo on a statue of a saint. I really do think that, like, I will hold up Paolo Bacigalupi's The Wind-Up Girl to any work of classic science fiction. And I will hold up Orson Scott Card's Ender's Game to any work of fiction in any genre, but certainly to to works of classic science fiction. And I just, I'm not a Heinlein fan, man. I just don't, I'm not into that stuff. And I don't like it when people say, well, you know, it's classic science fiction. How could you possibly not like that? It's the same. It reminds me of the same.
How your guy's like a pompous British ass.
Right. Well, it reminds me of the same argument I get, you know, like, well, that's not what the framers of the Constitution, you know, wanted. Yeah, my response is always, well, the framers of the Constitution, you know, kept slaves and, you know, believed that gay people should be burned at the stake and like all this other wonderful stuff. They didn't have any teeth. You know, there wasn't, do we really want
to? Women didn't have the right to vote.
Yeah, like, is that really what we want to be following? So, I mean, I have the same attitude, is that I really feel that people don't value the idea of progress enough in art. And I certainly, if someone comes somewhere to say to me, hey, you know, like, I've read The Star's My Destination, I think it's a great book, I got a lot out of it, and I didn't even know when it was written. That's one thing, and that I have a lot more respect for. But this canonical sainthood that seems to be showered on classic science fiction just eludes me. I don't understand.
I tend to agree with you, only because my dad had all the Golden Age crap. Sorry, I'm going to call it crap, most of it. The only one that I actually liked out of the, you know, sort of prominent authors was Ray Bradbury. That was it. And he at some point lent me, you know, the Doc Smith books. And, oh, my God, those are just painful to read.
He did that for me. Now, Bradbury, like The Martian Chronicles, it bore me to tears. Now, Fahrenheit 451, I think, is a great book. That book I really enjoyed. But the thing is, I like that book because it's a good book and I can lay out to you what works about it. It's not because it's Ray Bradbury. I could give a rat's.
No, right. I absolutely agree because, I mean, I'm sorry. There's a line between, recognizing the significance of the authors and their contribution to science fiction and the veneration that you've spoken of, you know, that they're held up above everybody else and you must worship them, which is patently absurd because, you know, not just because of the writing, but the content, you know, it's very problematic, a lot of it, and it needs to be recognized as problematic and probably not the best topic.
And you also see you really have a crisis in fandom over this because, like, I go to there are a lot of local cons that I go to where the majority of the people going to them are in their 50s and 60s, and there's not enough young people, new blood that are in there. I mean, like, you know, there's a short fiction magazine, one of the most venerated ones in the field, Asimov's. You know, most young people don't know who Asimov is, and they don't care. And if you want to keep science fiction and fantasy relevant, you need to be thinking about what's relevant to new audiences and having these geriatric cons where people are only talking about books that were written 60 years ago. Like, I mean, like, I go to them and of course I just love being around other nerds, but it's frustrating for me.
I hope you didn't just offend, you know, your entire purchasing audience.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I think they know what I'm talking about.
Well, it's been really interesting for me, too.
Let Paul get in. I think Paul keeps trying to get in.
I am. Have any of you read Among Others by Joe Walton?
No. I own it. I've been told by a very close friend whose opinions I trust that it's awful.
Yeah. Oh, I've been told it was good.
It's good. On the other hand, it does suffer from the problem that we've been circulating around. It does talk about books from the 70s and early 80s, and the relevance of some of those books to today's readers, as Mike pointed out, can be of limited utility. I mean, some of the books there's are classic and stand the test of time. On the other hand, some of the books I wouldn't want to reread anymore. I mean, I'm not sure I'd really want to reread Rendezvous with Rama by Arthur C. Clarke because, well, there are no characters and there's not much of a plot.
Yeah, and I think we maybe more of a separate, because I think Mike is thinking more like the 30s, 40s, and 50s, because the new wave is the new wave the 60s or the 70s?
Yes, 60s.
Okay.
Yeah, about that.
And
I mean, but
the new wave, I think, tends to break with what, because what Mike was saying earlier was that a lot of that older stuff, and I agree that a lot of it is, you know, it's great ideas, they're on the surface great story ideas, but that they're poorly written, they're, you know, they have kind of they take a lot of pages kind of from the pulp era of the 20s and 30s, right? Just kind of really quick, fast-paced plots and really big ideas, but not much in the way of writing substance. Whereas I think with something like the New Wave, you get a lot more of attention to the written form than you get. Yeah.
I don't want, and also I want to make sure that people listening to this understand, I'm not slamming other people's reading tastes. If people love classic science fiction, then they love it, and that's absolutely fine by me. I'm just talking about this sort of cultish acceptance of this is X, therefore it's good.
Like when people, I mean, it goes to the big questions, right? When people say, well, what would you suggest to a non-genre reader what to read? And they always go, oh, you should read X book by one of the five greatest white male writers from the 50s, right. You know? And it's like, no, don't suggest that book to these people. They are going to fucking hate it.
Right. And hate science fiction as a result.
Right. Because they'll read a book which is, for its time, was a great novel, and for the history of the genre is a really important book, but it's not great writing. If you want to give them great writing, this is my problem with suggesting books to non-genre readers altogether. You have to know what kind of stuff they like to begin with. What is it that they're reading right now that they enjoy? And then you have to suggest based on that, finding genre works that play with similar sensibilities. But then people, they just read some Heinlein. It's like, yeah, because they're going to love Heinlein. The guy who loves David Foster Wallace is going to love Heinlein.
You know, this is the equivalent of someone saying, hey, you know, I really want to read fantasy. I watched Game of Thrones. I really enjoyed it. You know, now I want to start reading. What should I read? And you turn around and go, well, you should try Lord Dunsany. You know, you just alienated this person.
Or they're Tolkien. You could even say it about Tolkien.
Well, yeah, frankly, yeah. I mean, Tolkien is thick stuff, and it doesn't appeal to a lot of people. Frankly, this is one of the big challenges I always have is, I love being a nerd, and I love the tribal sensibility of having this sort of geek culture that I'm a part of, and other people don't know. But the truth is that one of the things I love about Comic-Con and Dragon-Con and the huge popularity now of things like Game of Thrones and Walking Dead and the superhero movies, and the fact that not just us in this podcast, but people in the, and I'm doing finger quotes here, mainstream are excited about The Hobbit, is that I really would like to share that joy with as wide an audience as possible. And I guess that's the thing that I'm rebelling against when we're having this discussion here about classic science fiction, is I don't like the sort of tribal entrenchment in these classics when you know full well that it's a thing that makes the genre less accessible and not more accessible to the public at large.
Right. We're essentially doing science fiction and fantasy a disservice by associating as tightly as we do with the classics. But alternatively, you know, it's like my dad grew up on the classics and also with the new wave. But it's really tough to get that older generation to understand and appreciate a lot of the new science fiction that's coming out. Like every time I recommend a book to him, he just kind of loses it. You know, he'll read part of it and he's like, eh. And I'm like, seriously, The Wind Up Girl, for instance, I gave that to him and I was like, Dad, this is an amazing fucking novel. You have to read it. And he read like a chapter and then went, eh. And I wanted to beat him after that.
Does he like books with strong political elements?
See, and that's the problem. I have gathered that he doesn't. He really doesn't. Even though this guy who went through sociology and, you know, that was like his minor and everything, he really doesn't seem to enjoy. He likes the escapism portion of science fiction and fantasy. He does not enjoy the, you know, the much more speculative,
overt
social commentary.
The Wind Up Girl appeals on other levels. I mean, not just James Clavell's Asia series, Shogun, and Gaijin, King Rat, Noble House Whirlwind. Those books are, of course, incredibly political, but that's not what. They have far too much mass appeal to be mere political pieces. It's the intricacy and the interaction of interesting people, I think, much like The Sopranos or Modern Family or even The Walking Dead, that makes that book work. And it's the same thing with The Wind-Up Girl. I mean, The Wind-Up Girl is a truly great book.
It is. I agree. I think a lot of it, what it is, and let me just say real quick. I think one of the things that appealed to people about the sort of the golden age of science fiction, and then like Tolkien in terms of fantasy, is the sort of black and white distinction between good and evil. You know, that there was a very hard line. You knew who was evil. You knew who was good. Modern science fiction and fantasy has a much larger gray area, which I think turns a lot of older readers off.
Because they're looking for escapism into a world where things are defined.
Well, yeah, exactly. Where it's less problematic in terms of, you know, it's...
They know current. Who to hate and they know who to love.
They know who to hate.
And so they read Tolkien and Shannara and all those things. But then they go to Game of Thrones and they're like, who am I supposed to hate?
Yes,
exactly. I hate all of them and love all of them at the same time.
And right. that is frankly, that is when I know I'm in the presence of a great writer. When I see Jaime Lannister push a little boy out the window, and then go, when I get when I get to his POV chapters later on in the series, I love him and root for him and understand why he did what he did. I mean, I'm in the presence of a great writer.
I still hate Cersei. Yeah.
So, Paul, you want to jump in?
Yes, I did. I do think that the complications of modern science fiction and fantasy novels, especially fantasy novels, though, going from the whole grim dark movement and having complicated protagonists who aren't exactly all white knights, can turn off some of the older readers and some of the longer time readers, although if they did pay attention to some of their older stuff, Fafnir and the Grey Mouser weren't nice people either. I mean, some of their adventures were capery, but yet they were thieves. They stole stuff.
And Elric of Melniboné was a real anti-hero. But Paul, I would argue that in both of those cases, those series aren't that old. I mean, Michael Moorcock's still alive, and no one considers those to be what?
Oh, I'm sorry. Just that was like the way you said that. Like that's your basis for why the series isn't old. Like he's still alive. He's 187, but he's still alive.
And it's interesting because I mean, I say this. You know, my dad doesn't like the sort of gray area, and yet he's the same guy who loves the Stephen Bruce Vlad Talto series, which obviously you know he's you know a lovable ruffian sort of thing, but he also enjoyed the Chronicles of Thomas Covenant, which I'm sorry. Yeah. There is very little redeeming about Thomas Covenant, in my opinion, but, you know, whatever. So it's a tough, I don't know. I have no idea. I've just given up on my dad, really.
I think for your dad, it has a lot to do with, like, you read something like Wind Up Girl, and while the politics are not really the main point of that book, it's very clear it's dealing with serious contemporary political issues directly. Mm. And maybe that for him turns him off.
Yeah, I don't know. I would suggest that a number of people of his generation have very similar opinions.
And then,
I don't think
he's
an abnormality, basically.
People of his generation read.
They
That's
do.
True.
But that is a problem. Getting the young people to read, rather than just living with the smaller and smaller aging population of science fiction and fantasy fans.
That books like The Hunger Games, series like The Hunger Games, introduce science fiction and or fantasy at a modern level with the political sort of undercurrents in a really positive way. And you might end up with a few more younger fans just based on those.
Yeah, and we're going to need more, I think, statistical analysis on how ebooks have changed. Because I see people reading all the time on buses now.
Yeah.
When I ride the bus, there are people with e-readers, and they're reading something. I don't know what they're reading, but they're reading something.
They're reading, Sean, they're reading 50 Shades of Grey, every last one of them.
On one hand, I hate that with every fiber of my being. On the other hand, they are reading actual words that are in sentences.
Honey, though, they're reading words at a level that is not much further advanced than maybe a third grader.
Well,
and
to be totally honest, a lot of Americans barely read at a third grade level anyway.
Exactly. It's actually average, I believe, is fifth grade level.
But you'll like this, Jen. There's a lot of boobs in...
I have heard that, and yet I will never, ever, ever stoop to read 50 Shades of Grey.
Well, I stooped to read it. I mean, I'm a firm...
You did!
I did. I'm a firm believer. I'm a firm believer that if I'm, you know, if I'm going to talk about something, I should know, you know, I should have the firsthand experience. So I read it, and I can honestly say it is a bad book. It's and it's not even good smut. I mean, there is
right.
There is,
that's a crime.
Yeah, I mean, there's good erotica out there.
I mean, the parts that I've read of it, I was like, seriously, this just makes me sad.
What kills me is that, like, if what you want is to have something that's erotic and titillating, go read Laura Lee. You know, yes. Like, there's some really, you know, go get an Alora's Cave anthology. Like, there's tons of really good smut written by, you know, Circlet Press, written by people who really take erotica seriously.
Sorry, now yes, I'm dreaming about reading.
I wanted to write some, yeah.
All right, Paul, last word on our topic.
The old stuff isn't always good. Try some new books. Ask a younger reader what they like. I mean, and also try some YA. Some YA novels are surprisingly sophisticated and suitable for adults.
Yeah.
In fact, a huge portion of YA readers happen to be adults. So,
yeah, I am one of them. Paolo Bacigalupi again with Shipbreaker, you know, yeah. Technically a YA novel. Ender's Game is technically a YA novel, and I think that's one of the most important novels ever written.
And thank you, by the way, for saying Shipbreaker with the P. I had to stop listening to a podcast because for 4 episodes in a row, they kept saying Shipbreaker. And I was like, it's Shipbreaker.
Sean,
there's
Sean,
a P.
No, Sean, they weren't saying that. That was just what you were hearing.
No, I was hearing Shipbreaker.
They didn't think the book was called Shipbreaker. They thought it was called Shipbreaker.
Yes, but they said T. It was a T. I had to stop because I was like yelling at my headphones. It's Shipbreaker.
Yeah. Right. So, what else do we have going on?
All right, what was the last one?
Well, we're almost out of time, guys.
Yeah, we are almost out of time. All right. Well, I mean, this has been lovely. I really appreciate you guys. And Paul, thank you so much for giving us the technical scoop on the frames per second issue. I really had not known that that was going to be an issue. And I also didn't know it was going to be 3 hours, which will help me measure how much fluid I intake before I go see the film.
No big gulps before the film.
Just, you know, strap a bottle to your thigh and call it good.
No.
Sean, are you laughing or are you like huffing CO2?
That's Sean's happening? Version of a giggle.
I'm just imagining Mike walk into a theater with the giant medium sized soda strapped to his leg.
Yeah, so this is definitely the strangest podcast I've ever been on.
This one? I'm sorry. I suppose we weren't recording during the strange portions of our previous podcast.
I should tell you something. I have been on a lot of podcasts since I became a professional writer, and I have never heard the words horse penis used in the course of the show. And so this is a first. This is a big first for me. Thanks, Sean.
Well, did you know that Michael Fassbender is a horse whisperer of the sexual variety?
Wait, what?
What?
Okay. Here's the story. Ready? You ready for it?
No, don't. What? I don't even want to hear it.
He's not intentionally doing this. Calm down. So the story goes as follows. Jane Eyre, Michael Fassbender's in Jane Eyre, and there's scenes when he rides on a horse. Well, every time they put him on this horse, it kept getting an erection. Every time he would get on the horse and try to ride the horse, and they would have to get him off and stop filming.
That are in Sean's brain.
No, this is information a friend told me because she's obsessed with Michael Fassbender. So they would have to basically walk the horse to get him to walk it off. And it became a joke on the set because anytime he got on this horse, it would just get aroused.
Because mentioning a horse penis in this podcast wasn't bad enough, Sean.
But now you know he's a horse whisperer. We know.
So I can now never see a Michael Fassbender film again. Actually, I can probably never see a horse again, which is going to be tough for me living in New York City.
Oh. Okay, are we done now? Please tell me what's done.
Ladies and gentlemen, Skippy and Fanti ruined my life.
You're welcome. So, Mike, let people know where they can find you.
I am the author of the Military Fantasy Shadow Op series. The first novel, Control Point, has been out for almost a year. The second novel, Fortress Frontier, is coming in a few months. You can find me on my website, www.mikecole.com. It's MYKECOLE. You can follow me on Twitter at Mike Cole, or follow me on Facebook at facebook.com/Mike Cole. And that is, again, Mike with a Y.
Yep. And you can find all of our details on our website. So That's it. Thank you. Well, two of you normally would be here. So thank you, Mike, for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. And we'll see everybody else some other time.
Okay.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
In your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.